Hey everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I am Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, the podcast where we are joined, as always, by all of you, because none of us is as smart as all of us.
Certainly not me, I will tell you that. This week, we're going to have our final book club of 2017, very last one. It is the classic novel, A Wrinkle in Time, by Madeline L'Engle.
And we had a wonderful conversation with one of her granddaughters, Charlotte Jones Voiklis. It's just, I can't wait for you to hear it.
We're also going to hear what you thought about this book, A Wrinkle in Time. Turns out this book was important to a lot of you growing up. That includes Kendria Monica, who says she used to get in trouble at school for reading the book while walking in the hallways.
Looking back, I believe A Wrinkle in Time is why I got hooked on science fiction and fantasy. Wow. But after finishing the book this time, I realized its impact may have gone deeper, for I've long remembered what Meg learned. We can't expect others to protect and save us. We each must assume responsibility for our lives, and that love is stronger than fear or darkness. Also, I realize now that not only did Madeline L'Engle introduce me to physics, she also introduced me to metaphysics. Thanks for taking me down memory lane. It was a blast.
We are going to hear more from you in a bit, but first we're going to find out more about Madeline L'Engle.
We don't live or become real if nothing ever happens to us. I was having tea one time with a priest who became a bishop, and we were talking about everything in the world, and I finally said that I had to admit that all of the best in my writing has come out of pain, has come out of things that have hurt me. And he said calmly, "Let's hope something terrible happens to you soon." I really wasn't very appreciative of that, but we do learn from the things that are hard, from the things that hurt us.
So that obviously was Madeline L'Engle. She would have been 100 years old this coming November. Her obituary ran in the New York Times when she died, because obviously she was Madeline L'Engle, and we're going to have that on our website. It's makemesmart.org. Also, there's a movie coming out in March, a book about her life in February. You're going to hear about that in just a second. Also, though, she is a really, really, really good example of the kind of persistence it takes to become an author. I mean, for reals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and when you consider the time in which she was growing up and trying to become an author, it's pretty amazing. We'll have some more details on that. She knew that she wanted to be a writer since she was a child. She always said that. But as an adult, she wanted to, quote, pull her own weight financially. Sometimes those things don't always go together.
Yes.
Sometimes. Publishing is also a really hard industry to crack, when, especially when you're also raising three kids and trying to pull your weight financially. Madeline L'Engle got a lot of rejection letters. She kept writing.
Yep.
And A Wrinkle in Time was finally published in 1962 when she was in her mid-40s. So don't give up, everyone, because she went on to write more than 60 books.
Also, mid-40s, it's really young. I mean, it depends on where you're coming from, I guess, but it seems really young. Her granddaughters...
I'm not there yet.
I'm past it. Thank you very much. But her granddaughters have written a book about her life. It's called Becoming Madeline. It's coming out this coming February. Charlotte Jones Voiklis joined us for a conversation about her grandmother, and we started with what this book, A Wrinkle in Time, meant to her growing up.
I knew that my grandmother had written this book that everybody loved. And so at first I was a little reluctant to read it. Mm-hmm. I don't have a specific memory of reading it for the first time, except that it was sort of always part of our discussions as a family, and always part of knowing that my grandmother was so much like Meg was part of how I came to understand and love her.
When you were in, like, 10th grade, did all your friends know that Madeline L'Engle was your grandmother?
Oh, gosh. No, because...
Oh, is that right? Oh, wow.
Because I didn't want them to know. Yeah. So when I was younger, I was really proud of announcing that my grandmother wrote that book if I saw anybody reading it. But then when I became a teenager, I was sort of embarrassed and afraid of kind of the assumptions people might make or the judgments they might make about me if they knew that. And I remember at one point I was in high school and my grandparents visited for Grandparents' Day. And of course, my grandmother was married to an actor. My grandfather was Hugh Franklin, who played Dr. Charles Tyler on All My Children.
I know. And so I watched him.
Sorry, just saying.
I just had to throw that one out there.
Secret soap fan. You wouldn't have guessed that about
him. It was college, middle of the day. What was I going to do?
Homework? All right, we're off topic. Sorry, Charlotte. Please continue.
So he was immediately recognizable, mm-hmm. but my English and my religion teacher in high school immediately recognized my grandmother. And my English teacher invited me to introduce my grandparents to the class because they were visiting. And I just said, these are my grandparents, and said no more. And they moved on.
And that is that.
And that is that.
How you mentioned that you saw a lot of the character Meg in your grandmother or vice versa. How are they similar?
They were similar in that they were both so passionate and impetuous and unable to hide their feelings. Meg has a problem that she shows everything, not just to Charles Wallace, her brother, but to the world. I think my grandmother did get better at that as she got older, but she was still always that unsure, anxious, but incredibly smart and passionate teenager and young girl who knew what she believed when she was put on the spot. Like, Meg is unsure about a lot of things, but as the stakes grow for her, it becomes clear, and she has to make some really hard choices, and she's able to make them. And I think my grandmother was the same way, and I can really hear her voice in all of Meg's lines, sort of most especially when she's calling Charles Wallace and saying, I love you, Charles Wallace. I can hear her say that.
All right, I'm going to get a little personal here. Was she demonstrative as a grandmother?
Oh, yes.
I mean, there are a couple of pictures in this book of you and Lena sitting in her lap and reading to her, but was that true life, as it were?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. She was very affectionate and loving. And really the sort of the bond between grandparents and grandchildren at its best is so amazingly special. And I'm so lucky and blessed to have had her and had that in my life. She really was amazing. She read to us. She sang to us. We were very close.
How do you think she became that way? I mean, your descriptions of her parents don't give the impression that that's how they were. You know, where did she sort of find that inner affection and warmth?
I think she needed, I think we are all born that way, needing and wanting and being able to do that. And sometimes it gets driven out of us or we never get the example. But I think for her, it was just such a deep part of who she was. And I also think she found it from reading. She was a lonely child, an only child, was awkward with friends or awkward with peer group. So she didn't have very many close friends, especially as a youngster. But she had her books. She'd come home and instead of doing homework, Kai, she would read books.
Just saying.
Well done. So, Charlotte, how did you go from... You know, you grow up and you only revere, in some cases, your parents and your grandparents later in life. How did you go from the kid who didn't want to say who your grandmother was to writing this book?
Sure. Well, it's not that I wasn't proud of her or that I was ashamed of her. It's just that I didn't want me to be defined by my relationship to her. So that took a while to get over. But I lived with her in college and through much of graduate school in New York. And again, we were very close. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about writing this book, I was reluctant at first. I didn't want to change my relationship to her. She's my grandmother. I didn't want to study her. I felt that that would change how I felt about her, what distance I needed from her. My sister was all in and very enthusiastic, so she brought me along. We decided to do it at the encouragement of the publisher, but also her 100th birthday or centenary is coming up. And she loved celebrating her birthday. And we wanted to do something. We wanted to do something special. We wanted to give her a great birthday present. And I think this was even before the movie, that it was clear that the movie was going to be so spectacular and come out in her, you know, her 100th birth year. So I was like, okay, we'll write a book and happy birthday, Gran. But the universe has conspired to make it a great 2018 for her.
A little more from Charlotte Voiklis, Madeline L'Engle's granddaughter, about Wrinkle in Time just a bit. We should let you know, though, that her book, which she wrote with her sister Lena Roy, called Becoming Madeline, can be pre-ordered right now. It's a good little book. We both read it. Right, Molly? We read it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we did.
We read it.
And it comes out on February the 6th in 2018.
You tried to put me on Front Street a little bit there.
Well, a little
did
bit.
You read, I read it.
I also read this book, but we're going to get there in a minute.
Kai read it very closely. Yes, we will have our thoughts later. Fun fact from the obituary that I think is worth noting about A Wrinkle in Time. It has been one of the most banned books United States.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Probably right behind like Catcher in the Rye or something.
I was sort of looking through the obit again. It's been accused by religious conservatives of offering an inaccurate portrayal of God and nurturing in the young an unholy belief in myth and fantasy.
Hmm.
And that unholy belief will come to theaters March 9th. In the movie, directed by Ava DuVernay.
That's a segue for you, ladies and gentlemen. That's a good one. We specialize in,
boom.
In them here at Make Me Smart.
That's right. We're professionals. Next up, we will have your thoughts about A Wrinkle in Time. What a response. Like, you all were so delighted to read this with us, and I love it. But first, no matter where you are in space and time, I'm sorry to say, you still have to pay the bills.
You're killing it.
When I conduct a writer's workshop, the last thing I say is, when you write, don't think. Write. Because if you think, you're in control. You're in charge. You'll get in the way. Now, I'm not putting down thinking. I had a very good education. I'm very grateful for it. But there comes a point when you have gone as far as thinking will take you, and then you move into the world that might be called fantasy, which is that world beyond where your mind will take you. And then you stop. You stop short and you listen.
Oh, that, of course, is Madeline L'Engle. And she's basically describing the theme of Wrinkle in Time. Hmm. The second half of our conversation with Charlotte Jones Voiklis is coming up in just a bit. But now it is time for the actual book club part of our book club.
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait.
A Wrinkle in Time was rejected by 26 different publishers, being too complicated, too hard for kids to understand. Also, because publishers were told that nobody would read a science fiction story with a female lead.
Which, that alone, it took a while. Let's not mince any words, but that tells you how influential this book was on future sci-fi and fantasy franchises, because then, of course, you get The Hunger Games and Battlestar Galactica and Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Star Trek Voyager with a lady captain and on and on and on and on. Nerd time.
I don't think you had to give us the warning there, dude. I think it just showed up.
Would you like the whole list? Because I can do it. No, I will stop. A Wrinkle in Time, though, is the story of a young girl named Meg Murray, who is very much patterned after Madeline herself. She goes on a journey through space and time with her super genius psychic brother, Charles Wallace, and the boy next door, Calvin O'Keefe. And there's nothing particularly subtle about the plot, right? They are fighting a dark monolithic evil that wants to erase individuality and creativity. There's a big adventure. They meet a whole bunch of characters. There's a lot of God, and the evil is in the form of a giant pulsing brain.
We're going to start the conversation with a report from Delery Adams. Here you go.
I read A Wrinkle in Time in the fifth grade, and it became my book. It was my Hobbit, my Harry Potter, my Spider-Man comic book. It was my favorite book, and best of all, it was all through the eyes of a young girl like me. A Wrinkle in Time really started my love for reading. It's possible that because of Meg, I didn't realize that girls couldn't love science fiction, which for me extended to computers and eventually my career in technology today. Recently, I've been buddy reading A Wrinkle in Time with my 9-year-old daughter, where we take turns reading every other page. Funny enough, while rereading, I didn't remember what eventually happened, but I did remember how the characters in the world felt. Even being decades older, I'm still fascinated by the rather bold images and concepts this book serves up. My daughter wanted to reread the section explaining the Tesseract twice, and she really likes to do the voice for Mrs. Witch. We are reading at her pace each night and haven't finished yet. She wanted to take a break to read Christmas books, and she really didn't want me to read ahead, so I won't finish in time for the Make Me Smart Book Club. But that is the beauty of the podcast. I will just have to wait so that I won't spoil myself.
That's adorable.
That is beauty of the podcast. All right, Molly Wood, do you want to go first? Because mine's going to be relatively brief.
Well, I am within the zeitgeist. We have accidentally chosen a book that is very important to women.
Yes, yes, totally true.
Which I think is really, you know, it's sort of like accidentally wonderful timing.
Yep.
Because that's so much of what this book is about. And like I said, you know, look, these themes are not subtle. It's prioritizing feeling over thinking. It's prioritizing creativity over automation, right?
Yep, yep.
Automation of self. And it's about discovering that your father can't save you, which is really easy to understand from a kid's book perspective, but all themes that just like are so relevant right now. And I loved how throughout there's sort of all of these literary quotes and all these different languages and, you know, nothing is hopeless. When I read this, I thought of you, Kai Ryssdal.
You did?
Nothing is hopeless. Euripides, one of the quotes is Euripides. Nothing is hopeless. We must hope for everything. And I thought, I'm going to embroider that on a little pillow and send it to Kai Ryssdal.
Okay.
Except so that I'm not, because I don't know how to do that.
This is just going to make me sound like a terrible human being. Given that all of the things you said are true, and also you thought of me as that quote came up, this was not my favorite book ever. Let me just say that.
Yeah.
I didn't, and maybe it's because I didn't read it when I was a kid. Maybe it's because I'm a jerk. Maybe it's because none of this, you know, feeling stuff. Here I am laying it out. Feeling stuff doesn't appeal to me. I don't know what it is, but I wanted to. I was excited as the next guy, but it just didn't do it for me.
You've let go of your inner child.
Well,
it's, you know, I get it. You're not a metaphor kind of guy.
Right,
I
mean, that's exactly
yeah.
it. Right.
I mean, I'm reading this and I'm thinking, this is a metaphor for what everyone is, not everyone, but what some people are feeling, that there is a dark cloud shrouding Earth right now. And how do we fight it? And we fight it with love. And, you know, we fight it with creativity. And we say, you know, there will no longer be so many pleasant things to look at if responsible people do not do something about the unpleasant ones. I mean, I'm all about the metaphor. I'm the person who, taking geometry in, I guess, junior high, could not have been less interested until the point when the teacher went up and wrote, like, okay, now we're going to learn about the distance between the points. And I was like, I'm going to write a poem in this book. Like,
oh my god, this book
spoke to my inner preteen girl.
Oh my god,
I was like, that's so beautiful. The distance between the points, yeah. I love it. You're a practical guy.
My geometry teacher said, we're gonna measure the distance between two points, and I said, what time is soccer practice? You know.
It's okay. We're going to get you there, like, slowly. Yeah. We're going to slowly get you
there. All right. Well,
you can pick the next book.
Well, you know, no, we're going to put it up to a fair vote. You picked one, I picked one, and we're going to put it. We'll have an actual fair vote this time. No, I'm kidding. All the votes have been fair. All the votes have been fair. Next batch of comments. Bill Denny starts us off. He said he enjoyed the book more as a kid than as an adult. I really should have read it as a kid, I guess, is the name of this game. Here you go, Bill Denny.
People are not so one-dimensional as depicted in the book, where the children, father, and the three spirits are good, and the brain called it is bad. So I think the book, if read as an allegory, may just feed people's tribalism.
I feel like I really tried this time to understand the quotes that Mrs. Who and Mrs. What's It and Mrs. Witch were leaving for them. They were so archaic and old English that I had to read them out loud to understand them, but they struck me as very Buddhist and not necessarily Catholic in origin, but I thought it was interesting that the book was banned because of that for a while when it first came out. But it's a great book for kids and for adults, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the movie, and especially who plays Aunt Beast.
The descriptions of the characters, especially Miss What's-It, Miss Who, and Mrs. Witch, were just so vivid and... especially when the wings, man, I want some colorful wings like that. I cannot wait to see how the movie interprets it.
The main issue that I have with it is the same issue that I have with a large subset of sci-fi and fantasy books, and that is the externalized, unambiguous evil. It's the issue I have with Lord of the Rings, with the Wonder Woman movie, and to a certain extent with Harry Potter. Real life rarely gives us such clear-cut conflicts. It's the conflict and the ambiguity of what's right and what's wrong in our lives that makes it story-worthy, and also it gives podcasters a lot to talk about.
I think this news cycle of outrage and self-righteousness is quite literally a real-life version of it. Outrage fails to succeed as it tires us out, and it allows us to fall under its spell of rhythmic, cyclical hopelessness. Our only way out is dialogue, honesty, compassion, and activating the care centers of each other's brains. We could all do with a little Mrs. What's It reminding us of how to defeat the its of our lives.
Rhythmic, cyclical hopelessness.
Damn, I know. I was like, scribble, scribble.
I know. Jody Zemel, Tim Scahill, Lana Gordon, and James Pahotsky there. Yeah. I mean, I get the metaphorical implications. I totally do.
Yeah. But like I believe Lana was saying, it's not subtle.
No,
it's really not. And there are subtleties in there. And I think, you know, what I think the, well, I guess it's not that subtle, but the sort of through line about patience, mm-hmm. right? The long game, which I think is definitely part of our political discourse right now, right? Which is like, yes, look,
yeah,
we're on a bear hunt. There are certain things we're going to have to go through, and it's going to require patience to come out the other side. And they're good lessons to be reminded of, but certainly they could only sustain, for example, a podcast for so long.
But this podcast is going to sustain just a little bit longer on this book. Just
exactly, because luckily you guys are so smart and interesting, and you have so many good things to say. Here is, in fact, a listener who's reading the book with his 6-year-old daughter.
Hi, Kai Molly. This is Bo Brinkman.
And I'm Elisa. Oh. We live in Irvine, California.
Oh, that's awesome.
The most important thing that A Wrinkle in Time taught us was that love is always the hero.
We also like that Meg's weaknesses turn out to be strengths, that she didn't need to be the smartest or the most talented to still do great things.
Happy holidays and keep reading.
Oh, God, now I'm definitely a jerk. Jeez.
Oh, I'm dying. Oh, like, if you could just bottle up cute kid voice and put it in a... That's her. Bo told us we were reading it at bedtime, but for the first time ever, she snuck away to her room in the middle of the day to read a chapter without me.
See, that's cool. That's awesome, right? And kids read. There is nothing better than kids reading. Let me just endorse that right here and right now.
And learning about love.
I know. Love is always the hero. We got so many emails and tweets and voice memos that literally could not fit in this program, even though podcasts are in theory of unlimited length, but we can't really do that to you. So we're going to do a post. Tony Wagner's going to do a post on makemesmart.org. Even more of your thoughts about the book at makemesmart.org.
Because they were wonderful.
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back in just a second with more Charlotte.
Make Me Smart and Marketplace are built, as you know, on independent nonprofit news.
That is right. We believe that it is our responsibility to bring reliable, objective reporting to as many people as we can, to support informed decision making, rare as it can be, and thoughtful conversations. And we're asking you to help us do it.
Here's the deal, and it's easy. For as little as $5 a month, become a Marketplace investor.
Isn't that a clever name?
I know.
And the payoff is that when you hear us on the air or online or wherever you listen, it's knowing that you're making it possible for us to reach more people in more ways with more content.
All right. So Molly just said what the payoff was. Here's the real payoff. You are helping us produce journalism you can trust, and that makes us all smarter. Now is the time to do that, gang. Donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks.
Theology does not say enough about God. It tries. The German theologians try. They try very hard. I don't much like German theologians. They're very useful for one thing, insomnia. You know? When I wrote A Wrinkle in Time, we were living in Northwest Connecticut, and I was asking all the big cosmic questions that we tend to ask as adolescents, but I was married and had 3 children. I was still asking them and finding no answers and reading theologians and finding no answers. They're not all as bad as the German theologians, but they still are dealing with things in terms of fact, which should only be dealt with in terms of fantasy. And I picked up a book which quoted Einstein as saying, anyone who's not lost in rapturous awe at the power and glory of the mind behind the universe is as good as a burnt-out candle. And I thought, I have found my theologian. And then I began to read particle physics and quantum mechanics, which I still read for theology, because they're dealing with the nature of being.
Oh, I love that. Madeline L'Engle, again, just delightful. That's funny. I often tell my child that I think that the scientists and the priests are essentially talking about the same thing. They just haven't figured it out yet, which is probably a very heretical thing to say, and now we're getting some emails.
That's right. We totally will, but that's all right.
A Wrinkle in Time has obviously heavy doses of both religion and science, and they kind of come together in these really interesting ways, much as they did in L'Engle's own life. So we started out the second part of our conversation with Charlotte Jones Voiklis by asking her, I mean, Madeline just told us, but by asking her where she learned all that science.
She didn't have a great scientific background at all, but she did read a lot and broadly, and she did read writers like Albert Einstein and Max Planck and Heisenberg, and I think she found in them, it wasn't just the abstract scientific principles that fascinated her, but she thought of the scientific concepts as metaphors for other kinds of life experience. Mm-hmm. So the Tesseract was that way for her. A favorite metaphor of hers was, you know, exploring the heart of the atom and what happens when we unleash something of great power that we don't yet know how to control. So she would say that when she read Einstein, she said, there, I found my theologian.
Wow. First of all, reading Einstein. And then second of all, understanding him to that point, right?
Nobody actually reads Einstein. You just read about
you just
Einstein.
Quote him. Yeah,
it's
equals
very
MC
intimidating.
Squared.
Boom, right.
Well, I think in the 50s maybe there were some more magazine articles that were accessible.
How come this book, of everything that she wrote, and she wrote a lot, right? But this book, as you point out, was rejected 30-something times until she handed it to John Farrar. How come this is the one that stuck and it became what she's known for?
I think it stuck because it's so true and raw and naked. It was really just her channeling a deep belief and wish. I mean, she wrote every day, she wrote more than 60 books. So she was a disciplined writer. She knew her craft and she was good at what she did. But she would also be very humble about what happened when she was writing a book, that she was a servant to the work, she would say, and that something was speaking through her. She wrote the first draft of this in 3 months.
Wow.
And then revised a lot. Revision's important, but I think she felt that it came straight from the very deepest heart of her. And I think that speaks to people. I think you can hear it. And there's something that's so deeply honest about it, but also grand in its adventure, but its moral and emotional truths. It's quite amazing.
Yeah. What do you think is the central, the one that speaks to you the most, the one you think is the most central in sort of the themes, you know, whether it's good and evil or the value of the individual or accepting that not everything can be understood rationally? I mean, there's so many sort of really profound, lasting things there, but what's the one that speaks to you the most?
Warning, I might cry. The one that speaks deepest to me right now is the message, the truth, that we can travel across the universe in hope of finding our Father who will make everything better, but he's not going to do it. And we'll find out that we have the strength and the skills and the gifts and the faults
to do it ourselves. And that Meg, it was always Meg, that she could do it herself. And for her to travel the universe and discover that, I think, is something very powerful. We have to do it. And each one of us can do it. We're not suddenly going to discover that we're a wizard or a demigod. But that doesn't matter. We each have a part to play. And we must.
Well, hell, Charlotte. Now you made me cry. Yep.
So there are times you know when an interview's over and it ends itself. And that was it. That was the end of the interview for me in Hollywood.
No, I'm in tears. So, Charlotte, that was beautiful.
It's true. Sometimes interviews end themselves, and that's what that was. Except we didn't stop. We asked Charlotte our Make Me Smart question. We did get, I will say, an interesting response.
Yeah.
Something I thought I knew.
That's a really tough question.
That's a big old hunker of a question.
Gosh, that is good.
So we ask everybody, Charlotte, this question. What is something you thought you knew, but it later turned out you were wrong about?
Oh. Let's see. I'm not going to go dark for you on this, which I usually could. We'll go the other way. Do you know about asparagus pea?
I do, yes.
Yes,
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I thought it was true that only certain people could make it.
Okay.
But now...
I love everything about this, by the way.
But now I think it's true that only certain people can smell it.
Nuh-uh.
Those are two
really?
Different things. I'm just saying, I did some... We had this argument at home, and then I went, you know, casually Googling. And I couldn't find the answer. I'm like, well, this doesn't seem like this was a controlled study. I don't, you know, this might be uncharted scientific territory for someone to figure out.
There's
got to
be a PhD thesis out there about that.
There has to be an answer. So So I don't know if I'm wrong about that, but I've come to accept that it's an unanswered question.
So, dear listeners, let's take this opportunity for a little audience engagement, shall we? Send us your thoughts about asparagus pea. Preferably not on Twitter, because that'll just look random. But email us. Let us know what you got. makemesmart@marketplace.org.
I mean, I see no reason why we can't have the randomness on Twitter.
All right, fine. Let's have some randomness on Twitter. Hit us up.
The answer, it's almost like a chaser. Like that. The Make Me Smart question was like a chaser to the, emotional.
That's right. That's right. Here's some really profound stuff. And also asparagus pea.
For my part, I think I am both a maker and a smeller.
Okay, so, TMI. On next week's show, I did not ask you. We're going to be closing out our deep dive into capitalism for the year with Sue Desmond-Hellman. She is the CEO of the Gates Foundation. No idea on her position on asparagus pea. or the namesakes of that foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates.
Right. We don't know. We don't know what they're.
I'll stop.
Yeah, probably. Because once you get to wondering whether, okay, I'm going to stop. Anyway, it is super interesting. You're going to love it. There is also, speaking of things you are going to love, a new episode of The Uncertain Hour live right now. That is our podcast documentary all about this season, federal regulations. And this episode is all about the opioid crisis and how federal regulations play a role and how one sentence, there's a great write-up on our website about how essentially one sentence in OxyContin's marketing material helped set off the opioid crisis. You have got to listen to it and read it. You can hear reporter Caitlin Esch, who is just so good, talk to Kai on Marketplace PM about it today, and read the piece at marketplace.org and subscribe to The Uncertain Hour right now, wherever you get your podcasts.
It's extraordinary, that piece. Please. Is. I'll tell you what. It's an extraordinary piece of journalism. All right, we got to go.
We do.
Even though podcasts can go on forever, they can't.
We have to. There have to be rules, people.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson and the senior producer, Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe. Our theme music is and was and continues to be composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. I don't know.
They're always working on it. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager, as always, is Deborah Clark. There have to be rules because, like Mrs. What's-It said, it's like a sonnet. It has rules, but you can do anything in between.
I don't know. I'm just, yeah. I don't know. I'm just here for the music, man.
A maker and a smeller.
Here it is. Here it is. Here it is. Oh, no. Oh, so we're getting the long version. Good. So we'll just vamp for a little while. All right.
I'm rocking out.
There it is.
I'm just rocking out.
No rocking. No rocking.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.